Talk to me about Barack Obama, President Obama. You've written a lot of, and I think in this book you write a fair amount about your mixed feelings, your support, your hesitation. Talk to me.
Oh, I love my dear brother, and you're absolutely right. I'd work very closely with him. I was so glad that he won. We needed to bring the era of conservatism and the age of Reagan to a close. The greed at the top running amok, the indifference toward the poor and the polarized politics had to be stopped. It's almost like Benjamin, you know, and the thesis on philosophy of history. Catastrophe piles records upon records, this pile of debris, and yet to almost put a break on history and call that progress because of the chaos being produced. And the age of Obama is really a break on the age of Reagan because we were just sliding down a slippery slope to chaos. But what happens is, of course, is that Barack Obama, I mean, he initially has to reassure the establishment, so he brings in neoliberal and neo-Clintonites to run his economic team and neoliberal and neo-Clintonites.
Your dear friend Larry Summers.
My dear brother Larry Summers, who I love so much and I forgive thoroughly, but I still oppose his policies. Why? Because poor people are an afterthought. And it's not Larry Summers, it's the neoliberal paradigm. Even today, they're talking about the recession's over. What are you talking about? Over for who? Right. Escalating unemployment, underemployment, increasing. Wall Street, more and more happy. Banks, which banks? Stable. We got 112 banks collapsing. Top 25 banks, stable. Oh, that's what recession is? I see your priorities. It's the corporate oligarchs. It's the plutocrats you're concerned about. That's been true for Summers, Rubin, Thurman, Goldsby. We can go right across the board. It doesn't matter what color the economist is. And I was sad to see Brother Barack bring them in. I really was. I would say the same thing about foreign policy. It's neo-Clinton recycle folk, no new vision, no new orientation, and we're going to end up with a peace prize and a war president. Now, how contradictory can you get? You see what I mean? So that I support my brother when he's right. When he's siding with the weak, with poor and working class people, that's what we need. They've been crushed by the age of Reagan. And yet, he just doesn't have enough backbone. He won't draw the line in the sand. He talks about Lincoln and acts like Clinton. Lincoln was a statesman because he grew. He had maturity. He started off a mediocre politician, but he grew. And it helped to have Frederick Douglass and Harriet Beecher Stowe and Charles Sumner and Wendell Phillips around to put pressure on the abolitionist movement. But Clinton, opportunist. What's the next strategy? What deal can we cut? Well, we got a health care bill. Let's cut a deal with the drug companies even before we generate it. Let's make what relates to the poor negotiable, a public option, so that the greed that's been at work with the drug and the pharmaceutical companies might never be called into question. It might just be less than a little bit, but they're going to make a huge bonanza anyway in the reform because the people will be buying from them anyway. Come on. Is that what the age of Obama is going to be? No. Sly Stone said, everyday people, age of Obama is the empowerment of everyday people versus neoliberal mediocrity recycle. So we got to put pressure on him. We got to protect Obama. We got to respect him as president, but we have to correct him when he sides with the strong against the weak. I think that Obama began, of course, as a community organizer deeply rooted in both King and Alinsky. I think as a politician, he has been holding issues of race at arm's length because he sees it as alienating white moderates and white independents, the center right, as it were. And it's become a habit, I think. It started in the campaign, and generally speaking, it takes him a while to get to Katrina. We can go on and on and on. He holds it at arm's length because he said, I want to be president of all Americans. Yeah, but 97% of Negroes voted for you. They're Americans too, right? So sooner or later, you got to talk about something that's distinctive, and it can't just be in the language of personal responsibility. We talk about personal responsibility. How come the wiretappers don't have personal responsibility? How come you're not investigating and persecuting them? What about the torturers? You really believe in personal responsibility? They did it. How come you're turning your back? But when it comes to Jamal on the corner, personal responsibility. You got that crack bag? You are going to deal with the consequences of the law. What about the consequences of the law for wiretappers? So don't use this language of personal responsibility as a dominant way of talking about race. We all need to be personally responsible. Jamal, wiretappers, torturers across the board. So that is very different than the legacy of King. One way of talking about it is, for me, musically, is that King, Mahalia Jackson, Curtis Mayfield, Obama's Johnny Mathis.
I'm talking with one of the truly great American minds of our time, Professor Cornel West. You do a lot of things. You obviously, teaching is the core of your life, speeches, books, hip hop, you're involved with all these creative efforts. Can I just make a suggestion that you try not to be a politician?
Oh, never.
I don't think it's going to work out.
Not if you're a blues man, you can't be a politician. Too much truth in the blues to deal with a politician. You're absolutely right. But even though I can say this, Lincoln had a blues sensibility.
That's the first time I have ever heard that.
You read that second inaugural address, brother. It's shot through the tragic comic. The mystery, God not siding on either the Union or the Confederacy, having to come to terms with the history of barbarism in American history, talking about what? The bloodshed of the 244 years of slavery that we tried to evade. See, that's blues-like. That's the truth.
Well, the Gettysburg Address, you know, musically may be one of the greatest pieces of
poetry.
I mean, it's just
the
rhythm and the words is absolutely. What else are you going to take on in life aside from books and hip hop? What has Cornell West got cooking?
No, I'm going to keep doing the same thing, though, brother. I'm just glad to be alive. As you know, when the cancer hit me and they told me just had few months to live, I said, my God, I've been invited to the banquet of life for almost 50 years. I've had an abundance of blessings. I'm ready to go, but I'll still fight it. And 8 years later, I'm still going. I plan to do the same thing because I have a lot of fun. You know, there's fun dealing with the funk. I tell you that. Oh, yeah, there's fun dealing with the underside and the night side because there's a lot of creativity and resilience everywhere you go, people who's suffering and resisting, people who trying to make sense of the world, people cutting against the grain, being able to laugh at ourselves, not laugh at others, but laugh at ourselves and laugh with others. The Richard Pryors and the Lenny Bruces of our culture, those stars that sit at the very top that illuminate so much for us, even as they undergo tremendous, tremendous suffering. So I just intend to be faithful unto death, though, brother. I'm going with a smile, and I go, oh, yeah.
You've managed to surf more pieces of the American dream than most, to say the least. From Princeton, New Jersey, to Union Theological Seminary, to Harvard multiple times, at Princeton a couple times, Yale.
Oh, that's true.
And then your roots and all the, you know, working in prisons. How do you enter so many worlds where you aren't necessarily a natural? You're not a natural prisoner. You know, my image of Princeton, New Jersey is you know, you don't fit my stereotype of the average person in Princeton, New Jersey.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. We love Princeton, but I'm not typical.
Well, anyway. but you obviously are having a lot of fun being Cornell West. What's the secret?
No, I think it's just a matter of being perplexed about the world and being open-minded, being affirmative and praising of others. The last chapter is really about gratitude. And when your soul is full of gratitude, it doesn't leave the ego too much space to operate. And that sense of gratitude has to do with a reverent attachment to those persons who've been a source for good in your life. It could be your mother, your father, your grandmother, your teacher. If you're religious like me, it could be God as well as other things too. The things that facilitate the kind of grace, the gifts that you know are unmerited, and the support that you know that were undeserved and unwarranted, and yet know you've got to pass on whatever gifts you have, whatever it is, you know. Speaking, teaching, lecturing, keep trying to touch people, keep trying to unsettle mind, keep trying to push people and be pushed by them. And in that regard, I can't conceive of a life where there could be more joy. And I plan to go on until the end. And when they put me in the grave, every inch of my body will be used up. Struggling, writing, having fun, and dealing with the funk.
Well, the human volcano, Professor Cornell West, thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for being here. Your new book, your new memoir, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud, is hitting the bookstores as we speak.
No, indeed. But thank you so much again. Stay strong in what you're doing.
You too.
Indeed. ATL, a wonderful place.
Thank you so much.